We refuse to allow the mayor or the courts or anyone to deprive the people of cherished and treasured rights to assemble and mass protest.
We will march past Madison Square Garden. We are not having a rally on the West Side Highway. We are not going to the West Side Highway.
The confrontation was not created by the police. The confrontation was created by the people who charged the police. Gentlemen, get the thing straight once and for all. The policeman isn't there to create disorder. The policeman is there to preserve disorder.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. That was Mayor Daley from 1968 talking about the cops in Chicago. Sadly and unfortunately, we can expect it again. The cops are here again to preserve disorder. Hundreds of activities are occurring. Hundreds of thousands of demonstrators are in the city, testing this city's commitment to the First Amendment. So far, it's been weighed in the balance and found wanting. Hear about this and more, and your rights to demonstrate, to be on the streets, and to be in the park on Law and Disorder.
I'm Heidi Boghossian from the National Lawyers Guild. For months, the media has covered Mayor Bloomberg and Ray Kelly's threats to arrest 1,000 demonstrators a day and their efforts to typecast protesters as violent anarchists. Today, we'll talk to lawyers, activists, and legal observers about what we can expect over the next week.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, Arab Muslim South Asian advocate for the ACLU. Where will more than 250,000 protesters peacefully assemble against the war in Iraq, the erosion of civil liberties, and the Republican National Convention? That and more coming up.
I'm Michael Stephen Smith, New York City attorney and author. The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th. At a certain point, it'll be irreversible.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, educators, counselors, and advocates. We'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope you'll be lawyers you'll like.
Alex Vitale, a sociology professor at Brooklyn College, is here with us in the studio. He's author of numerous publications, including the NYCLU report, Arresting Protest, about the police handling of last year's February 15th anti-war demonstration. Alex, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
At the February 15th rally, protesters were stopped, questioned, and searched. Should we expect the same during the RNC protests?
It's a possibility. This was also a subject of this year's litigation, that the police are enjoined from doing widespread, indiscriminate searches. They have to have some kind of probable cause to search an individual, or they have to have some reason to believe that a mass search would accomplish some very specific security goal. So we don't expect to see widespread searches, but it's always possible that we'll see something like that. And in terms of questioning of demonstrators, are you referring to the post-arrest interrogations about political beliefs?
Yes.
Yeah, that also the city got in some big trouble about, and they've said repeatedly that they will not do that any longer. And we will have the National Lawyers Guild will have attorneys in the jails, you know, monitoring that.
Who's most vulnerable to being searched?
Well, we know that the police have been working a smear campaign against so-called anarchists. So I think that, and I've seen police documents where they try to describe for officers what the black bloc is and who these anarchists are and what kind of destructive role they could play. So I think that's the current targeted population at these things. Now, of course, how does one recognize what an anarchist looks like walking down the street, especially given that if you've been following the traffic on the websites, they've been saying to dress like yuppies so that they won't be subjected to this kind of harassment. So we're going to be looking to see if there are discriminatory patterns like that.
For those of you just tuning in, we have with us in studio Alex Vitale, a sociology professor at Brooklyn College, discussing police tactics during demonstrations and what we can expect to see from the NYPD at the RNC. What kind of force has the NYPD used in the past, and what kind of force do you foresee them using this time around?
Well, on February 15th, as I'm sure most of your listeners know, we saw the police using horses to try to intervene, trample people, push them onto sidewalks. We saw the use of individualized pepper spray containers over large crowds. We saw the use of officers in riot formation. Now the city owns even European-style water cannons and armored jeeps, and we're hoping we won't see anything like that, but that's one of the things we're going to have to keep an eye out for.
We've heard about some unusual tactics that many of our listeners may not know about. Tell us about one of them, brain screeching.
Well, I guess there's been some talk about the use of high decibel audio equipment. The military has used some of this stuff in the past on folks who've taken up siege somewhere. They have bought these high-powered broadcasting devices that they've said publicly that they will only use to broadcast messages to large crowds that they don't have any other way of communicating with. The irony is that that's one of the things we've been pushing for, is their ability to communicate more clearly with the demonstrators. If they try to use that technology as a form of crowd control, then that would be something we'd be very upset about.
And what happens when they do use it?
I don't know all the technical details. Just my understanding is it's very unpleasant. You know, it's like the audio form of tear gas.
Last time I was at a demonstration, there was a video camera and cameras on cars by the cops. I know when I was a younger demonstrator in the 70s that we got that prohibited, basically, that you couldn't really take pictures of demonstrators because it was intimidating. Is there any kind of litigation around that? Are they allowed to take pictures? Do they make mug shots out of them? What do they do with them?
Well, the police are allowed to videotape for the purposes of training or if there's criminal activity underway. And that monitoring, taping, photographing is supposed to be limited to the Technical Assistance Resource Unit. There has been some litigation, the Hanshu Decree, but that has basically been undermined somewhat of late. And so it's still illegal for the police to surveil people for the purposes of gathering information and files on people. The difference is whether or not they're taking video of a large crowd doing something or whether or not they're going around and photographing individuals. And if you see them photographing individuals, you should make a note of that. And I would say to contact the New York Civil Liberties Union, which would be interested to know about that.
That was Alex Vitale, sociology professor at Brooklyn College, discussing police tactics against demonstrators here in New York. I'm Michael Ratner from the Center for Constitutional Rights. Hundreds of thousands of protesters are descending on the city to protest the Republican National Convention. The array of groups planning actions is astounding. There's the Bushville Tent City, a billionaire croquet party on the Great Lawn in Central Park, a Fox News shut-up-a-thon by Code Pink. The list is creative and long, and there are major demonstrations happening every single day. Big questions arise: what are your rights, particularly vis-a-vis the police in New York City? They have so far not done very much to help us protect our First Amendment rights. But here to help you protect yours is Bruce Bentley, the National Lawyers Guild Republican National Convention Coordinator. Welcome to Law and Disorder, Bruce.
Thank you very much.
Bruce, let's start from the beginning. Let's say I'm a demonstrator walking down the street in one of these demonstrations. What can I say? What can I do? Can I carry a placard? Can I scream whatever I want?
You absolutely have a First Amendment right to carry a placard, to shout slogans, to gather with other people. There are some laws and practices by the police you should be aware of in New York City. Any placard or sign should not be on any wooden stick or metal pipe or PVC piping. The police will approach you and ask that it be taken off the sign, and you'll be able to still carry the sign. We recommend that you carry signs on cardboard tubing. Also, if you are demonstrating on a sidewalk, just be sure that you leave at least half the sidewalk open to passersby. If you are planning to march in the street, you should know that you will need a permit to do so, but you don't need a permit to march on the sidewalk. If you plan to do any sound amplification, it's okay to have a megaphone, but if you plan to have any electronic sound amplification, you will need a permit from the police department.
When I'm walking down the street, let's say a cop approaches me and says, "What's your name? What are you doing here?" What do I do then?
Well, our advice has been tailored somewhat by a recent Supreme Court decision in Hybl, and there's been a lot of discussion among the lawyers, but our best advice to people out in the street when you're asked, "What's your name?" is to first respond, "Am I free to go?" If the police say yes, you should say nothing and walk away. If the police say no, you're not free to go, you should say, "I wish to remain silent. I want to speak to a lawyer," and then wait. The police will then make a decision either that they have enough evidence in their minds to arrest you, in which case, of course, you should continue to remain silent and ask for a lawyer, or they may decide they don't have enough evidence, in which case they'll release you and you walk away.
One question about just going to the demonstration at all. Should I carry identification with me? Should I carry my driver's license? I remember in the 70s, actually, we got advice to sew up our pockets so the cops couldn't plant marijuana on us. But I presume that that's not some of the advice today. But at least I think, should people carry identification?
We recommend that people going to a demonstration should prepare for the possibility that they might be stopped by the police, the possibility they may be arrested. In which case, we recommend that people carry one piece of photo identification, preferably one that's government issued, such as a driver's license. This is what you would need to produce if you were placed under arrest, and often can make the difference as to whether you're issued what's called a desk appearance ticket, which allows you to be released, or if you don't have identification, they may decide to keep you if you've been arrested so that you're in jail until you see a judge at arraignment.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking with Bruce Bentley from the National Lawyers Guild about Know Your Rights at the convention. If a police officer stops someone and says, "Let me look into your knapsack," what do you do?
Our recommendation is when the police come up to you, and the first thing they say is, "I want to search your bag, I want to search your purse," is to respond, "I do not consent to a search. You have a Fourth Amendment right to be protected from unreasonable searches and seizures," and that's our recommendation. If the police arrest you, the law does provide that they can search you incident to that arrest. But there's a lot of concern among people coming to the RNC protest that they may be stopped on the sidewalk and indiscriminately searched, and we are insisting that people remember this advice, again, very clearly, very firmly, and very loudly so people around you can hear, "I do not consent to a search." If the police go ahead and search you anyway, we recommend that you not physically interfere, but just continue to repeat, "I do not consent to a search."
And that would apply if a police officer tried to put his hands in a pocket, for example. Does that happen?
It certainly has happened, and we, again, would recommend that you continue to repeat, firm, loud voice, "I do not consent to a search."
Bruce, what happens if I'm arrested?
As we say on the front of our palm card, continue to repeat the mantra, "I wish to remain silent. I want to speak to a lawyer." You should say nothing else. If you are arrested, what's likely to happen at the scene is that you will be handcuffed, and in demonstrations we've seen the use of these plastic handcuffs, placed in a police van that will probably be nearby, driven to another location where possibly be transported from the van to a police bus until that bus is loaded. Then that bus will then go to wherever. At that point, the police department is placing people in a detention facility.
Okay, and isn't it true that one should never talk to anyone but one's attorney about the facts of the arrest while being detained?
Absolutely. That includes people that you're sharing a cell with, because you never really know who you're sharing a cell with. We know from the police department, from press accounts, that they have undercover police who are trying to infiltrate the different activist organizations. Those undercover police could well be sitting next to you. This is not to create a sense of fear among people, but it's just a safer course to take that you don't talk about the circumstances of your arrest. Certainly you can talk about how much you oppose the Bush administration and its policies, but don't talk to people sitting with you about the circumstances of your arrest.
The number to write on your ankles or wrist if you plan to be out on the streets is 212-679-6018 in case you're arrested or you witness an arrest.
We'll see you out there. Look for us in the green hats.
How'd you get such a catchy number?
That was Bruce Bentley from the National Lawyers Guild talking about what you should know as a protester at the RNC.
We have with us Gail Murphy, who's on the steering committee for United for Peace and Justice. Welcome to the show, Gail.
Thank you very much.
Gail, have you been involved with the days and days of struggle with the New York City government about trying to get them to honor our constitutional rights to assemble and demonstrate? You've obviously been part of that whole fight.
Well, I've been certainly in a supportive capacity. The steering committee has been watching closely what staff, and particularly Leslie Kagan, has been doing to try and get our right to peacefully assemble in Central Park with a permit.
So what's your take on what's been going down?
Well, I think it's very unfair. I think it's obviously an attempt on Bloomberg's part, on behalf of the Republicans, to squash our right to assemble and to demonstrate the Bush agenda. And it's an unfortunate situation.
How come United for Peace and Justice, who are now in court on the issue, didn't go to court a month ago?
Well, as you know, we're a coalition of 900 peace and justice organizations around the country. And UFPJ was under a tremendous pressure to get a final program in place. So when we initiated the permit process for Central Park and was denied, we were also getting phone calls from all over the country saying, well, where are we assembling? Where's the rally? Where do we tell our people to go, et cetera? So there was a lot of pressure to quickly negotiate the situation. When we were offered West Side Highway under conditions that didn't look at all negotiable, we accepted it. And then in looking more closely at the situation, the fact that it was a baking open highway, there was not going to be water provided, it would cost us an extra $300,000 to provide the necessary audio, we wouldn't have shuttle buses between the metro or the subway and West Side Highway, we rejected it. And also our coalition, many of our groups said that they would not attend if we accepted it. So we had to go back and say, no, we don't accept it, and we're resubmitting an application for a permit at Central Park, which was denied within, I think, practically hours, and which brought us to the point where we had to file a lawsuit with the city.
What do you think the reasons, not the stated reasons, what do you think the real reasons are that they don't want to let us demonstrate in Central Park?
I think that on their part was an attempt to undo us, to make it difficult for our planning, to make it difficult for our organizing, to keep people from coming to the city, to make it a context in which people would not want to participate and shrink the numbers. And we're expecting hundreds of thousands of people. And it's not going to work. We really want people to come out. People say they're going to come out. And New Yorkers, please come out.
Gail, why personally are you going to march on Sunday? And why are you involved in this to begin with?
Well, my involvement is through Code Pink. I am on the steering committee of United for Peace and Justice, but I'm also a co-founder of Code Pink Women for Peace. And so we are part of the coalition. Personally, I think it's important for every American who opposes the Bush agenda to come to New York And if they can't come to New York, to at least visibly oppose this agenda in their own communities. We have seen over the last nearly 4 years such harm come to our country, to global stability. And I think that rather than let the Republican National Convention whitewash what their platform and their agenda is about, we need to be here, we need to be vocal, and we also need to bring forward the constituencies who are not being represented. Immigrants, labor, women's rights, gay rights.
Gail Murphy, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder. Appreciate your coming down.
Thank you for having me.
The lawyers who brought a lawsuit in federal court for another rally on the Great Lawn. We're going to hear from our own Heidi Boghossian about a report that the National Lawyers Guild is releasing as a book this week entitled The Assault on Free Speech, Public Assembly, and Dissent. Heidi, can you tell us a little bit about the report?
Thanks, Dahlia. The report evolved as the Guild collected information over the past 5 years on different kinds of police tactics that we saw at mass demonstrations around the country, starting in Seattle, where we saw a lot of police-initiated violence that was subsequently blamed on protesters. So what the report does is compile different tactics and then support them by examples that we've collected from different demonstrations.
Heidi, I'm looking at the report now, and the contents contain a really long list of pretty technical-sounding police tactics like snatch squads, rush tactic, flanking, intimidation by media. Sounds pretty technical.
We thought it was important to actually put in one place the long list of different behaviors by police department that we've seen. And they've often been referred to by these names. Snatch squads have been around, but we're seeing, for example, a recurrence of those in the United States. They're used often in other countries. So we thought it was important to document in one text basically the arsenal of police activities that we've witnessed being used. Some things are used more in one state. Some things have been increasingly used. We've seen less lethal weapons used for the past several years, but different tactics vary, like use of containment pens, flanking with motorcycles and bicycles, using those actually as weapons against protesters.
How can listeners get a copy?
The book will be in bookstores in about 2 weeks. We also have a copy posted on the Guild's website, www.nlg.org, because the publisher agreed that it was important this be available for mass distribution.
What do you hope that this book will accomplish?
We have sort of three main points that we want to get across in the book. The first is that we've seen police across the country over the last several years engage in several trends that really unlawfully interfere with the exercise of protected speech in this country. There are three. The first is punishment absent illegal activity, violation of the Fourth and Fifth Amendments. Police-initiated violence, a dynamic that's been acknowledged by the UN Commission on Human Rights. How much the government has really infringed on our First Amendment rights over the past few years. Sadly, it's sort of been an encroaching process. But when we put all this together, we realized this is pretty alarming. We can't really go to the streets and protest the way we used to be able to.
Thanks, Heidi. The book is called The Assault on Free Speech, Public Assembly, and Dissent from the National Lawyers Guild, available in 2 weeks in a bookstore near you.
This is Heidi Boghossian. Joining us in the studio is Brian Becker, National Coordinator for the Answer Coalition, and Mara Verheyden-Hilliard, attorney with the Partnership for Civil Justice in D.C. This past Tuesday, the New York Times reported that a federal judge in Manhattan refused to force the city to allow a rally on the Great Lawn in Central Park. Brian, wasn't it your testimony in court on Tuesday that, in fact, events of that size have occurred on the Great Lawn in the past few years?
Yes, the government's argument is completely bogus. They say that since Central Park was renovated, in particular since the Great Lawn was renovated in 1996 and 1997, no events of the type that we have asked for a permit for have taken place. But, in fact, AOL Time Warner sponsored the Dave Matthews rock concert last year, the Central Park Conservancy, which is really a consortium of private donors, AOL Time Warner amongst them, sponsored an event on the 150th anniversary of Central Park last year. The New York Philharmonic, the opera, they not only have events that are huge in the tens of thousands, some over 80 or 85,000, but they have taken place during conditions of rain, in anticipation of rain. So all of the arguments that have been used, and they're shifting arguments, changing arguments, in fact, they indicate that the arguments are false because they are shifting. They haven't applied to corporate and government-sponsored events. They appear to only apply to those who are seeking mass assembly protest against the Bush administration's domestic and foreign policies.
So you're saying that the city's arguments are not based on fact?
You're being too generous. The city's arguments are really an amalgam of lies that they presented to the court. The court ruled, deciding not to grant a preliminary injunction against the city for the denial of our permit, although the judge made it quite clear that he believed that Central Park, including the Great Lawn, could be available for mass assembly protests.
Mara, you filed the lawsuit last week. Can you tell our listeners some of the claims on which your lawsuit was based?
The City of New York and Mayor Bloomberg are engaged in content-based discrimination. They have an unconstitutional system whereby groups that are favored, groups that are sponsored by, for example, AOL, Time Warner, or Bloomberg, or other corporate entities, including major donors to the private Central Park Conservancy, get use of the public's Great Lawn in Central Park. And others who are people seeking to advocate for their rights and for others' rights and to fight against the Bush administration's war drives do not get access to the lawn. And that's content-based discrimination. The other element of this is that they have a completely unconstitutional licensing scheme that allows for unbridled discretion, unfettered administrative decision-making, where there is no binding criteria. It allows the city and its administrators and its corporate backers just to make determinations on an ad hoc basis. The government of New York City, Mayor Bloomberg, and the city officials have decided that they are privatizing Central Park, that they are taking Central Park away from the people of New York, and that bit by bit by bit, the people of New York will no longer, for the future, be able to use Central Park to engage in mass political assembly. And we know that that has to be fought.
I know that the judge asked both sides to meet and negotiate in good faith this weekend. That happened?
In judges' chambers, following the emergency hearing that took place last Friday, there was an opportunity presented, really by the judge, an arena created for a possible resolution between the parties. Now, the city and Mayor Bloomberg had introduced new reasons for the denial of the permit, and some of them that came at the very last minute, things that we had not been told before. For instance, we had selected no alternative rain date. Our event was not a ticketed event. And thirdly, and this they brought up at the very last second, they said, Answer wants a permit for a mass assembly rally at the Great Lawn in Central Park on Saturday, August 28th, and the United for Peace and Justice wants a mass assembly rally on August 29th. If we grant two rallies sequentially 2 days in a row, then that'll have a catastrophic effect on the lawn.
And attorney Mara Verheyden-Hilliard from D.C.'s Partnership for Civil Justice.
So in the judges' chambers, with both all parties present, and we invited the UFPJ attorneys to participate in that discussion, the Answer Coalition and the National Council of Arab Americans proposed the following, that if it rains, or rains substantially, that we would move the demonstration onto the Central Park West, in other words, onto a paved street, that we would post a $10,000 bond to cover $100,000 of insurance to pay for any damage done to the Great Lawn. Thirdly, that if the problem was two demonstrations 2 days in a row, that our demonstration would be willing to merge with the August 29th demonstration to make sure that that demonstration had a mass assembly permit in the Great Lawn. In other words, we satisfied in judges' chambers, every last-ditch explanation given by the city for the denial of our permit, and really for the permit of all mass assembly protests that weekend or during that time period at the RNC.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking with Brian Becker from the Answer Coalition.
And it was only the next day that the city rejected that offer. So the attempts by the city now to present the fact that they have tried to reach out and find alternative sites for the organizations and the groups seeking mass assembly permits, that it's the obstinacy of the protest group organizers that is the problem. They want to make sure that no protest mass assembly ever take place again in the Great Lawn in Central Park. They are shifting the historic significance of what everyone knows to be the heart and soul of this city, and the tradition of the Great Lawn is the tradition of mass assembly protest. What they're trying to say is Central Park will belong to corporations and to the banking elites. They're globalizing Central Park and preventing mass assembly protest in any other area except for perhaps the Bronx, Queens, Brooklyn. And we love those boroughs, and we want those people to come to demonstrations. But the idea that Manhattan will now be reserved for corporate-sponsored events rather than mass assembly protest, that's the complete obstruction, subversion, and overturning of the meaning of the First Amendment for New Yorkers, and we intend to fight that.
Brian, what do we expect this weekend?
I expect that tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people will come to New York. They will demonstrate all over the city. Many of them will feel that they have the right to go to Central Park, and I believe that they are correct, that they do have that right. And what the city has done has created an atmosphere of tension and an unnecessary atmosphere of intimidation, hoping to dissuade people from coming to New York. I think the opposite will happen. I think more people will come, and they will come to Central Park. And when they do so, they will be well within their constitutional rights.
Do you anticipate a large police presence at Central Park this weekend?
Well, it's clear that the mayor and the Republicans and, of course, the police have used the Republican National Convention and the overall, quote, threat of national security as a pretext to completely militarize New York City. So, yes, there will be tens of thousands of police. They have prepared the population for violence. They are setting the stage in order to initiate violence. And this is one of those moments where a lot of people are making last-minute decisions. Do I come or do I not come to New York City? And the message from the Answer Coalition is there's never been a more important time to come to New York City, to take a stand, to be unafraid, and to show that we have a right to be in the streets. If we allow the city, through regulatory schemes or through the creation of a political climate of fear, to strip the First Amendment of meaning, then we will have really changed the tradition of generations that went before. The First Amendment doesn't exist because it's as a gift from politicians. It exists because people fought for it, they stood for it, they went to jail for it, and if need be, people will do that again.
Well, I'll be looking for you out there on the streets this weekend, Brian. Thank you so much, and Mara, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks so.
In the studio, we have with us Brian Lonergan, an immigration attorney at Legal Aid in New York City. Thanks, Brian, for joining us. Welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
Among the protesters, we expect people with all kinds of immigration status. We expect green card holders, visa holders, people applying for a change of status, and undocumented immigrants or people who are even out of status. Can you tell us, are there special concerns for non-citizens in all these categories wishing to participate in the RNC protests?
Well, people need to understand that there is no immigration consequence for participating in a demonstration in and of itself. The problem that might occur is if there is some kind of civil disturbance or if there is an act of civil disobedience and somehow a person finds themselves arrested. That could be a source of concern for people who are not citizens.
So what happens when a non-citizen is arrested?
Well, when it comes to protests or acts of civil disobedience, traditionally the police department has handled it in two ways. One way is to issue people what's called a desk appearance ticket. That's usually done in the most peaceful and already pre-planned situations. With a desk appearance ticket, a person is taken into custody, they're fingerprinted, and the police wait for those fingerprints to come back. And that can take 4 or 5 hours. And if the person's record is clear, they'll be released and asked to come back to court or told to come back to court on another day. The problem for non-citizens is what happens with that fingerprint report. If the fingerprint report indicates that there's some reason to continue to detain the person, that will put them at great risk. Some people are arrested and held for arraignments. Well, it's the second way that the police deal with protesters. Usually within 24 hours of their arrest, they're brought before a judge for a judge to make a determination on bail status. If a person somehow doesn't get out of the arraignment situation after they see the judge, if the judge holds them over, they will be taken to Rikers Island. Right now on Rikers Island, there are a number of immigration officials whose job it is simply to detect non-citizens who may be subject to deportation. And, you know, in my office when we were preparing for this interview, we were trying to think of the various scenarios where people could be adversely affected. And we were wondering, what if somebody was marching inadvertently behind a group of anarchists that suddenly decided to throw rocks? And they somehow got caught up with that. You know, are they going to be in trouble under that provision? I mean, I couldn't give you a definitive answer. It's certainly something to consider.
Well, so, considering the way the government's overreaching in that area, yeah. I mean, the center's declared one part of that law unconstitutional in terms of material support, but it's certainly not an exaggerated viewpoint to think that the government could very well decide, well, that's a terrorist organization and you're marching in cahoots with them or behind them or in some capacity is giving them material support, even using First Amendment rights to support them in some way, saying they have a right to demonstrate would be considered giving material support. So it's not an exaggerated view as to how far they can use this law.
One exception, though, let me rise to the defense of anarchists. Anarchists are not rock throwers. They're peaceful protesters, although there are government provocateurs that are rock throwers. They're baiting the anarchists. That's what I'm afraid of. And we saw this during the Vietnam protests, is that the government has agents on their payroll. And they pay these guys for what kind of information they give them and how much information they give them. And these guys are, like, encouraged to do stuff. And they're given real long chain. And they invent things, and they do things, and they create things, and they cause trouble. And one fear I have is that there are all sorts of government agents out there. You can be sure of it, on real long chains. And some of them may provoke the kind of problems that we're against and call the police down upon all of us. And that would be something that would really endanger an immigrant who got caught up in it.
Thanks, Brian. The ACLU also provides free pamphlets detailing what to do if you are contacted or stopped by the FBI, by the police, by immigration officials. You can get a free copy mailed to you or a box of free copies mailed to you by contacting MAME at 212-549-2517.
Joining us now is civil rights attorney Carol Sobel from Los Angeles. Carol is also co-chair of the National Lawyers Guild Mass Defense Committee. Carol, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
It's true, isn't it, that you worked on the recent Guild and Partnership for Civil Justice lawsuit that was filed in federal court about granting a permit for the Great Lawn?
That's correct. I co-counseled it with Mara Verheyden-Hilliard and Carl Messing.
And I bet out in California you were a little surprised at the decision.
I was more than a little bit surprised. You know, I understood the hearing had gone extremely well, and I believe that the evidence that we put in at every turn refuted the city's arguments, and so I was surprised.
Just so our listeners know, you filed a lawsuit against the Los Angeles Police Department in the wake of injuries from less lethal weapons used in L.A. at the 2000 Democratic National Convention?
That's correct. We also filed two preemptive litigations before the Democratic National Convention to protect the rights of the demonstrators. One, to get people close to the site, the Staples Center, and the second one, to prevent the police from doing preemptive raids on the Convergence Center. And all of those were successful.
Great. Is anything still pending?
What's still pending is the settlement, the final settlement of the lawsuit that the Guild brought to change the department's policies on how they police demonstrations. And we are close to settlement, but we have not quite finalized it yet.
Are you hopeful in that case?
Oh, we're very hopeful. They've already stopped doing, as part of our settlement discussion, stopped doing kinds of things they were doing at the outset, which included using motorcycles to strike the demonstrators when they were standing lawfully on public sidewalks and shutting off the sidewalks. We didn't have pens like you have in New York. We had shoulder-to-shoulder officers with less lethal weapons. Mm. And they have stopped that now. They no longer block us in. People can move, enter, and leave freely. We have no constraints, no physical constraints on the demonstrators.
That's great. And weren't you hit by a rubber bullet?
Between the eyes.
Oh, dear.
Between the eyes.
You know, Carol, we were talking earlier about our concern with losing our rights to assemble because it becomes more and more impossible once you lose them, we get them back. What do you think's at stake here in New York City as this thing is unwinding?
I think a tremendous amount is at stake. This is the biggest city in the country. It's a city that sells itself as Parade Town USA on its website, and a city that sells itself as representing New York and representing the country. And I think that the heart of this country is the right that every person in it has to express their support and their opposition to the government and to various individuals and policies. And for New York to shut that down, which is essentially what they've done, because what they've said is if we pull out all of the big places, if we don't give a big piece of land, then we can limit the number of people who can get together. And the smaller the group, the more we can say, see, not many people care about this issue. So I think it's extremely important because you all know you had that huge demonstration, the largest in the country, February 2003. It is not the case that New Yorkers don't care. They want to come out by the hundreds of thousands, if not the millions. And for New York to take away the last large place, I think, is other than the streets, is really a tragedy.
Yeah, and not just for New Yorkers. It's really a regional center here. But I think what they've been very consciously doing is holding out the possibility of violence, equating dissent with lawlessness, dissent with violence, the possibility of violence, trying to limit the number of people that come, not granting a permit so people feel insecure about assembling. That's the kind of atmosphere we have here now. It interested me when you said that you brought preemptive lawsuits in Los Angeles. That was a good tactic.
They did the same thing here. They had a videotape that they took around that said the anarchists are coming, and we had the anarchist convention here the week before the Democratic National Convention, or a few days before. I actually think that, you know, what you said about hyping the violence is a little bit of an understatement. They are, it is their major focus at this point. The latest thing is that the people who were, the Weather Underground people who were recently released are really behind this all to really strike fear in the hearts of New Yorkers. And I think it backfires because not only does it look bad for this military state to be confronting people, as it did when it was Kent State. You know, my generation was the youth of this country then. Now we are still out there, but we are, you know, the baby boomers getting ready to retire and in a couple of years, and we're still out there. But not only does that backfire, but it backfires economically on the community because you saw what happened in Boston. No one came. The hotels were empty, the restaurants were empty, the city got shut down, and the same thing's going to happen to New York. So you take these conventions with the promise of benefit for everybody, and New York is going to shine. And what shines out to the world, what you shout out, is that we are a military state, and it's not safe to come here.
And to quantify what you said, the headline on the New York City Sun this morning was that this demonstration is going to cost New York City $309 million.
Mm-hmm. It's you know, it cost a huge amount here in L.A. It cost a fortune in Miami. But it's like the Pinto, the Ford Pinto. The bean counters are saying, well, in the long run, we think it's worth it. But I think if you put it to the voters, they would say that we don't want this. We don't want you coming out with weapons poised at the heads of our children. And secondly, the reality is that, you know, they hype this violence, but where has this violence occurred? They always point back to Seattle, but, you know, the demonstrators, the people who are coming out, the anti-globalization people, were not the people who engaged in violence to the extent there was violence in Seattle. A lot of it was the police. It's been the case around the country, whether they use agents provocateurs or infiltrators. We know that from D.C. We know that from Genoa, Italy. So we've got the police committing violence to make their self-fulfilling prophecies come true about violence.
And Carol, isn't it true that when we find that out a year later, such as in Genoa, where it was determined that a police officer had actually, I think, thrown a Molotov cocktail, it's always buried, you know, on page 30 of the newspaper, if it's even covered at all.
Exactly, Heidi.
Carol, it's been a delight to have you join us on Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Seeing you in New York.
Thanks, Carol.
Yes.
Okay. Jim
See
is coming
in, the streets.
In, coming in Friday. I hope that we run into you. Jim Lafferty out in Los Angeles, head of the National Lawyers Guild out there. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Mike. Glad to be with you folks.
Yeah, well, we're glad to have you on it. For our audience, a brief introduction, Jim. You go back all the way to the 60s. I know now you're one of the leaders of the movement out in California, but back in the 60s, you were one of the main organizers for the big anti-war demonstrations against the war in Vietnam. And one of the reasons it's such a pleasure to have you on the show is we wanted to ask you about things back then. And actually, what I'm especially interested in, because after 7 or 8 years in the streets, I remember the first demonstration against the war, which we all thought was a tremendous success, 1965, Washington, D.C., Clark Kissinger organized it from SDS, and there were 20,000 people there, and we thought that was just amazing, get 20,000 people out. At the end of the day, we had hundreds of thousands of people in the streets.
Well, about a million on April 24th, 1971.
Right. Not long thereafter, the United States was humiliated and forced to withdraw entirely from Vietnam, just like we're hoping to get them to withdraw from Iraq. So here's my question, Jim. You were involved in it then. You're involved in it now. Why are we building mass demonstrations? How did it work then?
Well, you know, if you were to read Nixon's memoirs, LBJ's memoirs, McNamara's memoirs, they all say the same thing, that what caused the defeat of the U.S. imperialists in Vietnam was two main factors. First of all, of course, the valiant fighting by the resistance forces, the liberation forces in Vietnam. But secondly, the powerful anti-war movement in the streets. It was those mass protests of hundreds of thousands of people in the streets that Nixon and LBJ credit with staying their hand and forcing them ultimately, together with the victories of the Vietnamese on the field, to withdraw from Vietnam. Now, that took a number of years. We're in that process now. We already see that the majority sentiment in this country has turned against the war in a far shorter period of time, and happily with far fewer body bags than we had in Vietnam. There is a Vietnam syndrome. It is still alive and well. People are still skeptical about these foreign interventions. So I have great confidence that ultimately the mass movement of the anti-war movement, which is again already spread into the armed forces, will prevail.
What's the relationship, you think, between the massive demonstrations here at home and the American soldiers over in Iraq? I mean, what was the relationship between the big demonstrations during Vietnam and the American soldiers who were drafted and sent over to Vietnam?
Yeah, there may have been a certain amount of resentment, obviously, because it was the poor that are always drafted and sent to these wars. But once they got there, once they understood that this was not a war which was in the vital interest of the American people, as they had been told, once they understood they were dying and killing not for America but for someone else, and then they began to see popular sentiment at home manifesting in the streets with every sector of the population taking to the streets. By about 1971, even Colonel Heinel, writing in Army Times, mentioned that we were no longer drafting an army, as he put it. We were drafting an anti-war movement. That anti-war fever began to spread. So you had folks who had been demonstrating on their campuses or hearing about how wrong the war was finally finding themselves over there and with no will to fight, simply a will to stay alive and to survive. And you're already seeing that happening in Iraq. The soldiers want to come home. In some cases, they've named their military bases after Camp Texaco, Camp Mobil Oil, Camp, you know, and so forth. They know what it's about, and they don't want any part of it at this point. And the longer the stay, the more they and their family members are asking to come home.
What's your take on the stance that Bloomberg and the government here in New York City has on the anti-war demonstrators that are expected.
Well, I think it's pretty obvious what it's all about. I think what actually the Republicans are hoping for is disorder in the streets. I think they're hoping for something, the repeat of 1968 in Chicago. You know, Mike, in 2000 here in Los Angeles, when the Democrats were here holding their convention, we had to go to court to get permission to be across from the convention center, and we won that. The Democrats, if we had had a Central Park here, would have been happy to buy buses to take us 3 miles away to a Central Park so we wouldn't have been near their convention site. Here you have the organizers of this mass protest in New York willing to go several miles away to Central Park, and you've got Bloomberg, a Republican, and therefore, of course, the Republican administration not wanting anything like that to happen, not wanting to grant permits, really, knowing full well that the reaction of the of people is going to be anger over that, and hoping, I think, that there will be such disorder in the streets that it will inure to the detriment of Kerry and to the advancement of the cause of George Bush. I think it's transparent, and I think it's outrageous.
For listeners joining in just now, we're talking with Jim Lafferty from the Los Angeles chapter of the National Lawyers Guild.
Jim, I understand that you're going to be in New York.
Indeed.
What are your hopes? If everything goes well for us, what are your hopes for what we can accomplish on Sunday?
Well, I'm hoping that the hundreds of thousands of people that will be coming to New York still come, despite what the court rulings, that they're not intimidated, that they are not willing to back down in the face of this repression, that they come and powerfully and peacefully and militantly demonstrate in the streets of New York. I'll be there along with Bruce Bentley and the Lawyers Guild chapter in New York with our green hats on, defending the right of protest, trying to make sure that the police do not run rampant over the rights of the protesters as they have done in some recent times in New York City, defending the right, if you will, to continue to protest in the streets. And I'm hoping at the end of the day there will have been massive protests, that the arrest will have been minimal, that the police provocateurs that are no doubt acting there won't have much success, and that this strategy on the part of the Republican Party of trying to turn peaceful protest into riotous protest will fail, and that the Constitution will therefore have been defended in advance.
Jim, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder. We look forward to marching with you Sunday here in New York.
Thank you. We look forward to seeing you all.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That was Jim Lafferty talking with us from the National Lawyers Guild in Los Angeles.
This is Michael Smith. I'm out here in the street with Jeff Fogel. Jeff Fogel is Director of Litigation for the Center for Constitutional Rights. Jeff, congratulations. You did a real good job fighting. And that decision came down last Wednesday in the state Supreme Court. I know it was the wrong decision, but sometimes you have success without victory. I have a question for you, Jeff. You argued beautifully, and Judge Jacqueline Silverman of the state Supreme Court came down against us, wouldn't let us have our rally in Central Park. What were her reasons? What were her reasons and what were her stated reasons, Jeff?
Well, I think this was a done deal, Michael, before we walked into court. I sat there and watched Judge Silverman not take a single note during the entire day of testimony. I read her opinion. She ignored the testimony that was presented to her. She ignored the law that was presented in our briefs. She came up with every conceivable reason why we shouldn't have the park. We got there late. We reneged on a deal with the police department, and that the grass is much too precious in Central Park for it to be crushed by protesters. This was a done deal before we walked in there, but you're right. We did do a good fight. It was an important fight, and guess what? It's a fight that's only just begun.
So what do they think the state of civil liberties are in New York City today?
You just have to look back on last February 15th to see when the federal courts refused to even allow a march. Now we've got a march and they won't allow a rally. Someday we're going to return to the basics of the First Amendment and be allowed to have a march and a rally. Wouldn't that be extraordinary? But as I said, what really has opened up from this case, I think, is that a coalition is going to get together and is going to liberate Central Park from the clutches of the rich people and the corporations in New York. And that's what came out very clearly from the testimony, that Central Park has been taken over by that class of people, and we have to fight that.
Civil liberties, use it or lose it, right?
Absolutely. And one of the most extraordinary statements that Mayor Bloomberg made was trying to use these protests to justify a new stadium for the Jets where he could stick the protesters in. And that's really where it's at. He would like to see the protesters stuck in a box speaking to each other and with no cacophony out on the street. Well, that's not what the First Amendment's about, and that's not what New Yorkers are about either. But I'll be in Central Park, and I'm looking forward to seeing hundreds of thousands of other comrades in Central Park as well.
And Jeff, I'm looking forward to seeing you in Central Park too.
Thanks, Michael.
That was Jeff Fogel, litigation director at the Center for Constitutional Rights. One last thing, Jeff, what's your website?
www.ccr-ny.org. And right on the front page of that website is a Know Your Rights brochure. I'd encourage people who are going to be out doing any kind of demonstrations this next week, take a look at that brochure.
Thanks so much, Jeff.
You're very welcome.
And thanks so much to our producer, Jeff Brady. Get out on Sunday. It'll do us all some good. It's Michael Smith thanking all the listeners of Law and Disorder, and we'll see you again on September 10th.